Accession number 27748, Reel 2.
Land control services were still covered in doped canvas to make them lighter, and so we used to sew linen onto tailplanes.
Richard Songo, Reel 2.
When we finished sewing them on, you had to tauten it with dope and then paint it with the camouflage colours and all that. So you covered every field of aeronautical engineering. Then you worked on engines, took them apart, put them back together again, all that sort of thing. And then one day...
What kind of planes were you working on there?
Oh, really old, beaten up things like Fireflies. And Dominies, you know, Dominies with de Havilland biplane, you know, that hence a lot of canvas work. We were working on worn out aeroplanes from the fleet, that's what it boiled down to, so that, you know, we could take them apart and put them together again. While I was up there, you can tell we were running the fleet air on down because we had a huge scrap pile, and I got a brand new Merlin piston out of this scrap pile, and I've still got it, use it as an ashtray. Brand new, it seems such a terrible waste. Straight out of a Spitfire engine, out of a Merlin.
Mm. And when was the first time that you went up?
When we were at Fisgard, I think it was, to interest people in the various trades, you know, they took you to, you know, you saw... ships being built in the dockyard to get you interested in the shipwright side. They took you to, well, we'd already been in the engine rooms and boiler rooms, so there was that thing. We went to Roeburgh, and they gave you what was called an air experience flight, which is in a Domini, and there was some poor old fleet aeron pilot who took us about 8 at a time in this Domini, and we just flew up. It was winter time, I remember it was freezing cold, and the smell of, in the planes in those days, smell of dope and aviation fuel. There was a very peculiar smell aeroplanes had in those days. And I can remember 3 of our lot were sick in the plane. So you got the smell of vomit mixed with the smell. It was awful. But then it was exciting to be up above, you know, Plymouth was quite a small place then. And Roeburgh was a grass airfield. And so we flew around. It was pretty quick, 10 minutes back on then. Because, you know, apprentices, I think my year was probably 60 boys, you know. So there's an awful lot to get through during the day, get them all fly. So that was our first flight in an aeroplane. Once we were at Arbroath, it was strictly maintaining them. There wasn't any fun like flying them. Mm.
Not at all? You didn't go up once?
No, not once. No, they didn't. No, you were to maintain them, not get ideas above your station.
So these planes, that you were dismantling them, reassembling them, did they fly, or were they...
No, they didn't. No, they wouldn't trust... No, they were definitely for instructional use only. Yeah.
And how long were you there?
I think I was about a year. And then I was asked by my CO if I'd like to go to Dartmouth. This is right out of the blue. And I think what it was, maybe the question had been asked in Parliament about the proportion of people from the lower deck who got commissions. And this, you know, why out of the blue? There was no system for this. I said I would. And I think they asked my parents if that was okay. And then I was put on the train to London, to the Admiralty, and we went to a room. Oh, we had to wear civilian clothes, that's right. Of course, our civilian clothes were really weird, because we weren't really part of that life. And Gives measured us for all our stuff. And a big trunk, I must have gone on leave at home, big trunk arrived, tin trunk, full of all these wonderful clothes made for me. Quite incredible.
Were you the only person chosen?
I think there were 3 of us. But we weren't all from the same place. There were only 3 of us this was called the special entry, which was largely public schoolboys, you know, Marlborough, all those, Shaftesbury, those sort of public schools. They comprised the special entry at Dartmouth, and it happened every year, I think, you know, this entry came to Dartmouth. And so we joined with them, so we all arrived there together, us from our naval background and them from their public school background.
How was it seen amongst your contemporaries when the CO said to you, do you want to go to Dartmouth? It must have been like a thunderbolt, really.
Yes, it was. It was all done so quickly. You know, once I'd had that interview, it was probably only 3 days before I was on the train. Yeah, so it was, you know, you only had time to say goodbye and you were gone. So you didn't really get much reaction, you know, because, I don't know whether they felt it was unfair or, I don't know. It was certainly a strange system.
So then you arrive in Dartmouth.
Yes.
Which again, I mean, must have been arriving at Fiskard at 15 multiplied by 10.
Yes, because then it was all the social thing, because these boys came from a completely different background. Plus, you'd already been in the Navy, and so you knew about the stratification in the Navy, which they didn't, but, you know, they were joining in the upper half of it. I can remember we hadn't been there more a couple of days that some admiral came to see the new intake, informally. And so we were all in the mess, and he said, "Well, you boys, no chaps, I think it was, you chaps, you don't realise it, but you've joined one of the best clubs in the world." That was terrific. Yeah, the best club in the world. And well, it was in a way.
Did you feel that?
Well, we didn't know, but you were, you know, you were so privileged. I mean, you've got all these wonderful clothes. You lived in this wonderful building because the RNEC at Dartmouth, or the RNC, Royal Naval College Dartmouth, it was a beautiful building. And you were fed like fighting cocks. You know, every day you had to do some sort of sport. And your instructors and the staff, the ratio was very high. You felt you were being treated wonderfully, you know, and people respond to that, you know. I mean, the trouble with children in, you know, these sink schools, no wonder they don't perform, because nobody's saying to them, you're all valuable. And all this was saying to us, you're very valuable. And so, you know, you react accordingly and work hard and, yeah.
I mean, in terms of rank and pay, I suppose that improved.
Yes, your pay was better, but then it was a complete life. It was like being at a university or something, you know. Your whole life revolved around the university. You didn't really need a lot of money. I don't ever remember going, you know, into town. You weren't encouraged to go into town, because you were supposed to be doing sport or some other activity, and at the end of the day you should be knackered. have any other energy. And there was so much going on, you know. There was the river, so there was lots of sailing and boating, because that was, you were learning about tactics and things like that. It wasn't just, you know, you were actually a part of flotilla, and, you know, when the leader said turn to port, you, all these little motorboats then turned to port, all that sort of thing. It was all learning all the time. In the evenings you had to learn Morse and semaphore, learn to throw heaving lines. You know, everything that a sailor could do, you had to do, and probably you had to do it as least as good and preferably better than them. So, I mean, you know, you did a lot of work.
But at the same time, you were being trained as an engineer?
No, this was all you being trained as an officer. So we were all the same. It was only later on that you specialised into what... But, of course, we had no option, I think. We were, you know, they wanted us to be engineer officers. So, I mean, but at the beginning, you all did the same training.
And was there any aspect of a finishing school etiquette? I mean, you'd come.
Oh, heaps of that. Yeah, heaps of that. Yeah. Yes, You know, there was the sword of honour, you know, and if you played rugby and you were the captain of the rugby team, you had a better chance of getting the sword of honour than anybody else. There was all that nonsense. It was very unfair, I thought, because at the end of my time there, I won the what was called the Sankey Prize. Sankey was like a workshop where everybody did woodwork and all these sort of things, and of course I was keen on that stuff anyway. So I won the prize, and then my divisional officer called me in and said he was terribly sorry, but I wasn't going to get the prize because I'd got, you know, I had all the advantages of being an engineer artist apprentice, so they were going to give it to the next chap. But I thought about it afterwards. I wasn't good at speaking. Thinking on my feet, well, I should say, well, they've had all the advantages of public schools for their thing. Why can't I win my... Anyway, so I didn't get the prize, which is the only time in my life I've ever been near a prize. I was a bit disappointed in the Navy about that.
Did you ever feel that you were slightly second best because you hadn't come from the...
Oh, there was a lot of snobbery, yes, and because I think I tried very hard. You know, I tried really hard because, you know, I was chameleon-like and adopt, you know, this accent I've got now is a received one. It's not, you know, it's probably a Dartmouth one, you know, because they all talk like that, so I had to talk like that, and they cut their food this way, and it's, you know, all those sort of things. It's a sort of subtle process. Well, it happens to all children, but we were a bit later than that, so you had to learn another way of doing it. So I learnt that sort of middle-class way of going on.
And what about flying then at Dartmouth? Did that happen?
Yeah, we again had one of these experienced flights, and it was at Roeburn, and I think it was in a Domini again, and so we all had that experienced flight. So that was my second flight. Yeah, I think it was freezing cold again, and the Domini was a very frightening aeroplane because it shook, and it was all the wing covering was all canvas, so you could see all this shaking around, and the airframe was, well, most airframes shake on takeoff when the engines are working hard. So I suppose if you wanted to interest people in aeroplanes, I wouldn't take them up in a dorm. But anyway, it was interesting from my point of view, yeah.
And were you still model making? Were you still keeping...
No, life was far too busy. And after a short time at Dartmouth, you went to the training cruiser. HMS Devonshire, which is a big three-funnel cruiser, which was completely manned by cadets. We were cadets at Dartmouth, and there were a few sailors, but they were as mentors. So the cadets did everything. They were down in the boiler room, they were in the engine room. If the ship side was painted, it was covered in scaffolding and stuff for the... You know, we did everything. We painted it. I can remember painting the centre funnel, you know, on ropes and... Yes, it was kind of...
This was moored in...
No, she was at sea. She went to sea. We went to the West Indies, and we went to... in the Med as well. Yeah, every morning we scrubbed the decks, all the decks, all the flats as the, you know, internal passageways are concerned. That was all cleaned before about 8 o'clock.
And what age was this ship?
She was a cruiser from the war. She was a counter-class cruiser, yeah. Yes. And then once a commission, you went to have breakfast with the captain, so you had to wear your number one uniform. And you lived in a hammock on a mess deck, scrubbing the table, going to get food. And then you went to the captain's cabin with his steward in your best uniform. And there, you know, he had a dining cabin and a sleeping cabin, and he had great big square portholes, and you sat down to this wonderful breakfast with silver knives and forks and toast racks and all this stuff and kedgeree and silver dishes, and you realised that that's where you were going. You may be putting up with misery at the moment, but that's where you're going.
Fear and trepidation as well, I suppose.
Oh, yes, because you didn't, yes. But, then, I mean, the dear old captain, I mean, he was in charge of us all, but I mean, he was trying to bring us on. You know, there was very much the impression that people all the time were trying to get you to do your best. You see, there was that too. Yeah.
And had you, you said you'd been commissioned by this stage?
No, we were still cadets. You weren't technically commissioned, no. And at the end of that time on the Devonshire, you then went to, you then went to sea as a midshipman. And so you were now in the proper Navy, as opposed to the training Navy, but you were still under training. And so I went to Eagle. And in those days you had gun rooms where the midshipmen and the warrant officers lived, which was a sort of junior mess room, ward room, really. And you, but you had a little cabin. I think you shared it with somebody else. Yeah, probably two of you, a cabin. And then you were generally a dog's body for one of the ship's officers, which is also very interesting because you relayed his orders. Really, that's what happened. You followed him around, and he said, you know, if you it was best to be somebody very senior, like the commander's dog body, because he'd say, you know, there would be a trouble with the anchor. You know, they couldn't get the anchor up, you know, and everybody was ready on the bridge to go. And the commander would say, swear, go down to the forecastle and tell Lieutenant, what the hell is he thinking? So you then run all the way down the ship, all the way down to the forecastle, and say, commander's compliments, sir, but could you give me any idea of how long you'll be? Then you'd run back to the captain and, or the commander and tell him what the reason was. And usually you were sent back down again with an even stronger expletive.
Yeah. You learned to dilute.
Oh, yes, you learned all sorts of things. You learned about how difficult it was being Lieutenant Bloggins with this awful machinery on the forecastle, and also, you know, what it was like being a senior officer trying to get a ship to move.
What about your political thoughts at this time? I mean, had you... You know, the communist ideas, the socialist ideas. It was quite an interesting time politically too, wasn't it?
Yes, I was, think I was completely... I think I was very much... we used to have to keep a journal, a midshipman's journal, and what you did, you... maybe the wardroom had... I think it mainly had sort of pretty right-wing papers, Times and things like that. And so you'd read what was going on there, and then you... Tracy a bit of that and write it into your journal and that sort of thing. So I think we were pretty right-wing, pretty conservative. Yeah, I don't think we were... Well, I certainly wasn't at that stage. I was quite oblivious of the fact that politicians could mess things up. No, at that stage I was not aware of that. I thought that everything was one, you know, was running along the right lines.
So how old were you now, Dick? When you're a midshipman?
Oh, I've got a crib sheet here somewhere. I'll have to... Yes, bear with me a minute while I look it up.
Okay.
Yes, it was probably about 1952 with HMS Eagle. And then we were we spent 6 months on her, and then she had a destroyer, which was called the crash boat, and that used to... follow along on the port quarter for any aircraft that fell in the sea, basically. That's what it boiled down to pick the survivors up. And she was the Ulysses. And I learnt a lot, well, both of us. I went with a friend, Ian Rycroft, to... We were the midshipmen on Ulysses. And that was a hell ship. It was run by a Captain Queeg. You know, Captain Queeg was the US Navy martinet in a famous film. And his ship was only half complemented because it was only a crash boat. It wasn't supposed to do anything but steam around, follow, and pick up if there were any accidents. But he wanted to show that he could run a real ship, and so he had gunnery practice and all the rest of it. He hadn't got enough men for the guns crew, so when the target went over the stern, they had to run from the forward guns to the after guns. I mean, it was a hell ship, and he was always screaming and wanting to know who's to blame. His cry was, who's to blame? You know, gun would stop firing. He'd send for the chief artificer, who was supposed to be looking after the guns. Well, if the gun's not firing, the chief artist is there anyway, trying to fix it. If you call him away, it's going to take longer. You know, that he was that sort of man. So the officers on this ship were in a perpetual state of fear and funk. But as midshipmen, we were completely immune to that, because all we did was follow around and relay the orders between them as they got more and more frantic. So we learnt a lot on that ship. And at the end of its commission, Eagle went somewhere, and the Ulysses came to Devonport and was going to be scrapped. And so we, Ian and I, were given the job of de-storing it, which meant that we had to list everything that was on that ship, and then as it was taken off, you know, tick it off, and that sort of thing. So that was interesting as well.
Did you sell any stuff over the side?
we had to go and look for it. We were always trying to find things which were not, you know, they were on the list, and if we didn't send them ashore into stores, somebody was going to have to pay for it. So, I mean, we were always scouring around for the odd hose hydrant and things like that. We had motorbikes then, Ian and I, we had old motorbikes, and we used to go out on trips to Dartmoor, only about 10 or 12 miles, but in those days they were big expeditions.
And what kind of bikes did you have?
Ian had a BSA, and I had a flat tank BSA, so it was probably about 1925, and I had an aerial Red Hunter, which was probably about 1932. They were heaps of junk, really, but they were good fun. Mm.
You've been, I mean, the Eagle, and the Ulysses was a crash boat. Did you actually pick up any? Were there any crashes that happened?
Oh, yeah.
Rescue?
Yes. I remember we rescued an attacker pilot up in the Solent. The attacker was the current first jet aircraft the Navy had, and had very poor performance. And they shot their aircraft off in the Solent to land ashore on Solent. And this one went off, and he was obviously in trouble. It didn't climb away, but it was still flying, and it gradually lost height and entered the sea about 3 miles ahead of the carrier. And we shot over there. We didn't have dinghies and outboards. It was the sea boat. So full of stern, stop the ship, lower the sea boat, and then they rowed over to the, well, it was called pulling in the Navy, so they pulled over to the attacker, which by then was settling in the water, and the pilot was walking or was crawling along the fuselage towards the fin. And just as we got there, well, the boat got there, it dipped, and he was in the water. And we got to him, and he was American. He was an exchange pilot, and he was really annoyed, because what he wanted us to do was get all his rabbits in the Navy. Rabbits were like presents you brought abroad or made during the commission, because they were in the cockpit. But I mean, by then the cockpit was underwater. We, you know, the poor cocks on the boat couldn't get them. But that was his. He didn't thank them for being rescued. He was annoyed because they didn't get his presents.
And what did this do for you and your interest in flying?
Oh, it was all very exciting. Yes, all this. Yes, I mean, the attacker was. It looked a horrid aeroplane anyway. There's something about things that are right. You know, if an aeroplane looks right, like cars and anything else, it is right. You know, there's something about the modernity of design, you know. If a thing looks right, it usually works right. And the attacker looked horrid and it didn't work very well.
I mean, I forgot to ask you, Dick, when you were on the Eagle, which was a carrier, to wander around the flight deck?
Oh, yes, we spent, yeah.
And what kind of planes were there?
Oh, they were then piston engines. They were Sea Furies, Fireflies, Gannets, Fairy Gannets. And in those days, it was a straight deck, and with barriers for every landing. And we used to spend, if we were not off watch or whoever we were doggy for didn't want us, we'd be up there. It's called the Goofers Gallery. Anybody could go up there, you know, sailors, stewards, and it was like being in the Colosseum and the gladiators were performing on the deck for you. And so we saw the most wonderful crashes. You know, they, and this was every day on the flight deck. Well, probably wasn't every day, but I mean, if you know, if it was a good afternoon, you saw something happen. And you, I mean, it was a, they were gladiators. They come in, if they missed the wires, you see, they hit the barrier. The barrier had to be up because the aircraft that landed before were parked on the front of the flight deck. So they'd if they floated over the wires, they would then hit the barrier. If they were very high as they floated, the undercarriage would catch the barriers and the aircraft would be flipped onto its nose. The engine was still running, so it would try and spin around like a top, probably splaying fuel, probably catch fire. You know, you can see it was a tremendous afternoon's entertainment. There were firemen already in asbestos suits there, and so we never saw anybody killed or even badly injured. You know, it was very efficient the way people got out of these wrecks. You know, that's what two of the firemen did. You know, that they got to the cockpit and they got the man out, and the others were putting the fire out. And if they just went into the barrier properly, then the propeller would get mangled up in the wires and all that sort of thing. And then it was dragged back, the barrier lowered, the wreck towed forward, then the barrier up, and they carry on landing on. Yes, they were all heroes in those days.
But why was it, I mean, you make it sound almost like it was routine that, that the planes would crash. Was this bad technology, bad training, bad flyers?
It's very difficult. I mean, I didn't go to the deck until they invented the deck landing aid. And it was then easy, and also you had the angled deck. So if you made a mess of it, you just opened the throttle and went round and had another go. These guys had to get it right first time. Not only that, the only way of telling whether you're at the right height, right speed, was visually. But you only had a few seconds on finals because the noses of those aeroplanes, they were piston engines, were stuck up at slow speed. So you were having to fly a curved approach to keep the nose out of the way while you looked at the deck. At the last minute, you had to straighten all that up, kick it straight, and have everything right. At the same time as watching your instruments, keeping the airspeed right, you had to be also watching the batsman, who was a human being who had these paddles that he raised or lowered to tell you whether you were high or low. So you can imagine the chain of events. You could one of those human links get it wrong, and you would be either too high or too slow or something. And so you got accident. The trouble is, thinking back to that time, I suppose there wasn't an accident every day, but there was a chance of an accident every day. Yeah.
And what other planes then most impressed you? I mean, walking through the flight deck, if you'd been passionate about...
Yeah, aeroplanes.
Anyway, and then walking through this story, it must have been the smell of it, and suddenly seeing all this. Must be quite an extraordinary experience.
Yes, it was. Well, the Sea Fury was the aeroplane then, because it was the fighter, and it was big, and it had this Bristol Centaurus engine, big radial engine. You sat up high in it. It had a bubble cockpit. It was the latest, and it looked like it was powerful, you know, with that huge radial engine. And pilots seemed to like it, and also they were an interesting bunch of people. You know, they were you had to be fairly carefree to be a freighter pilot. It wouldn't be too good to be introspective, you know, because you were performing in this arena every day. And so they were an attractive bunch of people. I mean, they weren't thinking about their careers too much, that sort of thing, whereas the others, a serious professional naval officer was always thinking about, you know, making good marks and doing this and doing well here and all that sort of thing. They were only concerned about their last landing, or the next landing, really, not the last one, the next one.
And you, as a lowly midshipman, you could fraternize? Yes.
I mean, this was the wonderful thing about midshipmen. You could talk to able seamen about splicing or his last run ashore, and you could also talk to the captain. You know, you were not a pet, but you didn't have any big responsibility, and you couldn't, without being diabolical, upset anybody's life. And so people were willing to confide in you and also train you. You were being trained all the time. People were teaching you things.